Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Montgomery Bell Academy.
This is a very important cultural moment. This is the farthest south Doris has been since she passed McLean once when she was lost.
He's impossible.
In Washington.
And he's my friend.
So this is very exciting. We appreciate you making us your diversity stop on your tour. Thank you, Anne, as ever, for your wonderful words. And we have a proposal in front of Christopher Guest, the filmmaker who made Mighty Wind and Best in Show and those. We want to start a movie called Book Tour. And the financing has not been there, but if you do what Anne said and buy books, maybe it'll be there. This is a great pleasure for me, a great treat. Most of us who do what I do when we grow up, we want to be Doris Kearns Goodwin. And I think I'm sure the first book I read of Doris's was her really remarkable book about Lyndon Johnson called Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. And she just gets better and better, which is also at once wonderful and kind of frustrating for the rest of us. But this is a great pleasure and a marvelous book and an important book, particularly at a time when a lot of us feel that perhaps the bully pulpit is not being used as one might. And so welcome.
Thank you.
And I'll just start. When did Roosevelt and Taft first meet?
They first met, and I didn't know this until I got into the book. I thought I'd just write about Teddy Roosevelt, but of course there have been so many good books about him that I had to expand the cast of characters just like can you hear me okay, or am I sitting on my thing? I think I'm okay. Just as I had to do with Lincoln, with 14,000 books written on him, so I had to figure out the team of rivals.
Sure. That's Andrew Jackson.
Why aren't I mentioning him? Anyways. What should we do about this?
I think you're okay.
Okay. He hears his moo, and he says, you're okay. Anyway, so when I started to do Teddy Roosevelt, I realized that I needed to figure out some other characters. And there were 400 letters between Teddy and Taft that I had never read. Don't you hear me? Making funny noises? Am I the only one? You can hear it? Yeah. Yeah. Can we have a man? No, the man put it on me. That's all I meant. This is getting worse.
It's very, very sexist.
I'm going to keep talking. Maybe if I just move away from it, it'll be fine. I think it's good now. So anyways, it turned out that they met when they were in their early 30s, and they became instant friends, which was somewhat unlikely because they had very different physical abilities. I mean, Teddy loved physical exercise, wrestling matches, boxing matches. Taft was a rather large man, so he was much more sedentary. And Teddy would take him on these walks, and they'd go through the woods, and they would not be able to keep up with each other. But nevertheless, they both were reformers. They were both allies as young people wanting to do something about the corruption of the age. And there was a lot of corruption in between the Civil War and the early 20th century. And they had opposite personalities, but I think it clicked in a way. Teddy said of Taft once, I envy a man with his personality because people love him at first sight, whereas it takes longer to get to the heart of me. And then Taft adored the idea that somebody could be such a fighter and would have such rhetorical ability and the things that Taft did not have. So that friendship began. They wrote these letters to each other. They had lunches and dinners together. And eventually, Taft is brought into Teddy's cabinet and becomes his closest advisor.
They came from two very formidable families. Talk about the backgrounds, the tributaries that led into that river.
That's a good metaphor.
Thank you. I try.
Yes, indeed. Well, they both came from, Teddy's family was probably more wealthy over the long term than Taft's. Taft's was, however, a sort of upper class, middle class family. And Teddy, of course, came from a real estate background where his father and the grandfather had been very wealthy in New York. But the father didn't really want to stay in business. And Teddy adored his father, and he became pretty much a philanthropist. So I think that's part of where the social interests that Teddy had developed. But more importantly, I think what happened in that family is Teddy's born with a really life-threatening asthma, and his father worries that he becomes a great reader, a great birder. He concentrates on everything. It sets the lifelong love of learning that's in him the whole life, and his ability to read continually, even through the biggest stress of his presidency. But his father worried that he was becoming frail and an invalid. So he just said to him, "Theodore, you have the mind, but not the body. And without the body, you can't go as far as you should. You must make your body." So then he promised, he loved this father, "I will make my body." And he started this crazy workout regime. It took him years to refashion his body, but eventually he becomes the exemplar of the strenuous life. And then very early on, he decides to go into politics, which was unusual for somebody from his background. It meant he had to go to the local hangout, you know, where there's a lot of Irish, my forebears are there, and he thinks, "Oh my God, they're smoking tobacco and they're not like me," but he eventually begins to get close to them and learn that these are the part of the people that he has to deal with. And even being in politics was looked down upon by the people of his class. On the contrary, Taft's father is a judge, and from the time Taft is a little kid, he just dreams about being a justice, because that's what his father was, that's what he wanted to be, and he gets appointed very young to be a judge in Cincinnati, almost as young as Teddy's in the state legislature, starting this long political career. And then, however, he gets appointed to be Solicitor General and goes to Washington, and his father is so thrilled, and he's worried about it, because he always is insecure at each new job he goes to. But his father says, "You'll be fine," and he writes to him when Taft is worried about it. And he also has a wife, Nellie, who really wanted him to be in Washington. And so we can talk about those two women at some point, because they're instrumental in the paths along the river, if I'm mixing our metaphors, that they both took.
The wading pool. Because this is the period after your most recent book, Team of Rivals. I'm sorry that did so poorly. By the way, I don't know if y'all have heard of this book. When Obama modeled his cabinet after Doris, we thought she was going to be okay that season. But you came through the beginning of Reconstruction. This is the progressive era coming 30 years later, roughly. But to what extent did what was happening in the broader country, life of the country, affect your choice of this topic? And what's the political lineage you think that they were acting in terms of from Lincoln to TR to Taft?
Yeah, I think in general, when I try to figure out who I'm going to spend so much time with, because it takes me so long to write the books, it took me longer to write about Franklin and Eleanor and the home front in World War II than it took the war to be fought. It took me 10 years to write about Lincoln and the Team of Rivals. It's taken 7 years to write about these guys. So the most important criterion is it's the person I want to live with. I could never write about somebody I didn't basically respect and really have affection for, even though they'll always disappoint you in one way or another, as all presidents do. And I want to live in a period of time that I would have liked to live in. So your question is right. I think I don't think I'd want to write about the 1920s or, you know, the 1970s, but writing about the Civil War, or writing about the Progressive Era, when it was such an activist time, and people from all sorts of lives were caring about whether it was the churches, the settlement houses, the reporters, the people in politics. They wanted to make the country a better place. And I think that's part of what it is. I mean, when you spend so much time with these dead presidents, you've got to feel that the life around them is interesting. My only fear about this career that I've chosen of dead presidents is that someday there's going to be a panel of all these presidents that I've ever studied, and every single one, don't you think about this sometimes? And every single one is going to tell you everything you got wrong about them, and this is the afterlife for me. And then the first person to scream out will be LBJ. "How come that damn book on the Kennedys was twice as long as the book you wrote about me?" So anyway, I love the era.
Size did matter to President Johnson.
Talk of sexism.
Get me a man. Right now, Ann is wondering why she got in the car in Saratoga. So yeah, so we do all worry. The problem with, I find the problem with subjects is it's okay if we talk to them, it's when they talk back.
Oh yeah.
It's no. Like, you know, The Shining meets C-SPAN. You know, you don't want that.
No, it's true. My kids remember when I was writing Eleanor and Franklin, and I'd be in my study, and they could hear me saying, "Oh, Eleanor, just forget that affair he had, you know, so many years ago. I know he really loves you." And then I'd be saying, "Franklin, just be more sensitive. She's not confident at some level about your relationship." And they're wondering what is going on in that study. But it, for me, it really did begin with knowing one president. So. I went to the LBJ Library the other night, and it was a really emotional going back, because that's, as a young kid, where it all began, because I knew that aging lion of a man in those last years of his life when he was so sad and so vulnerable, having done so much on civil rights, and yet knowing that his legacy had been cut in two by the war, and he opened up to me in ways he never would have without that. And I'd like to believe that that privilege just fired within me the drive to understand the inner person behind the public figure, and generally to look empathetically at my subjects, so that you give them a chance to speak their own words through, as you know, all the primary sources you can find, the letters, the private journals. I don't know what will happen 200 years from now when they don't have that stuff.
Right.
I couldn't be an historian without that stuff.
Right. Well,
that's not very articulate, that stuff. That, get me a man. So it's all gotten off.
We'll return to Lincoln, to TR, but talk a little bit about your own biography here, because you talked about meeting President Johnson, which began in conflict, right?
Right.
So embarrassing tell that
conflict.
Story.
Yeah. I mean, what happened is I was chosen as a White House Fellow, a fabulous program, when I was a graduate student at Harvard. And it brought people for a year to Washington to either work in the White House or one of the cabinet offices. Colin Powell was a White House Fellow, Wesley Clark. We had a big dance at the White House the night we were selected. President Johnson did dance with me, not that peculiar. There are only three women out of the 16 White House Fellows. But as he twirled me around the floor, he whispered that I would be assigned directly to him in the White House. But it was not to be that simple. For like many young people, I'd been active in the anti-Vietnam War movement and had written an article against LBJ, which unfortunately came out in the New Republic 2 days after the dance in the White House. And the title of the article was How to Remove Lyndon Johnson from Power. So I was certain he would kick me out of the program, but instead, surprisingly, he said, "Oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can." So I ended up working for him his last year in the White House and then accompanying him to his ranch to help him on his memoirs, to work on the civil rights part of his memoirs. And it was the transformative experience. I mean, I would have been an historian. I've loved history from the days I was a little girl. But I'm not sure I ever would have been a presidential historian. My PhD was in Supreme Court history. So I'm really glad that that affected me. And he was the larger than life, the most interesting, formidable person I think I've ever met.
You, given the way you write, you write in this marvelously personal yet epic way. They're terrific sagas. What were the important books that you read along the way that formed the basis that once you met him and that shift happened? What's the literary wallpaper?
I remember being in college and reading Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August, which is not only so stunningly written, but she was a female historian and she's writing about war. But more importantly than that, I remember she said that if you're going to be a narrative historian, you have to tell a story from beginning to middle to end. You can't let what you know later filter back into your writing. And the academic world, of which I was a part then, because I was teaching at Harvard, loves to make these analytical points where you stop the story because you're bringing something in that you know to make yourself sound smart, I guess. And so that's what made me know that. I mean, in some ways, I'd like to think I learned the narrative drive from those nightly sessions with my father when I was 6 years old, and he taught me that mysterious art of keeping score while listening to baseball games. So he'd come home at night, and I now realize in excruciating detail, I counted every single play of every inning of the game that had just taken place that afternoon, the Brooklyn Dodger game. And he made me feel I was telling him a fabulous story. It makes you think history's a great thing. But at first, not knowing the narrative art, I would blurt out, "The Dodgers won," or "The Dodgers lost," which took much of the drama of this two-hour telling. So I finally learned you had to tell a story from beginning to middle to end. But Barbara Tuchman is the one who taught me that and taught me narrative history. And I think just I felt so proud that she was. There weren't that many female historians running around at that time.
Right. I think she also said that, which is a corollary, you can write about the most familiar of events in a compelling way if you pretend you don't know the end.
That's exactly right. I mean, you have to only know what the people at the time knew. So she said, even if you're writing about a war, You have to imagine to yourself, you don't know how that war ended, because the people living there don't know how it's going to end. So that was huge advice for a storyteller.
Right. Our friend David McCullough also likes to say that people in the past did not walk around saying, I'm living in the past. Appreciate it. Clocks are ticking. So you did the Johnson book. You did worked on his memoirs. You did Johnson and the American Dream, which if you have not read, go immediately after you buy this. And then you went to the Kennedys.
Right. Then my husband had been a young speechwriter on the plane with Ted Sorensen in 1960 in the Kennedy campaign, and then stayed in the White House with Kennedy, did most of the Alliance for Progress stuff, actually stayed on with LBJ and did all of his great civil rights speeches. I'm so proud of those speeches now, more than anything that I've ever done in some ways. Those speeches are extraordinary. But more importantly, because of him, I'd gotten to know the Kennedy family. So they opened the papers that had been in the attic of Hyannisport for 50 years that were the Joe and Rose Kennedy papers. So I didn't write about his presidency. I just wrote about the three generations leading up to that, the Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys, but had access to all this extraordinary material that these people had written letters all the time. They kept their dance cards. It's as if they knew they were important from the beginning. They knew they were living in the past.
Right.
I will never forget one time I was reading Rose Kennedy's letters to Joe and Joe Jr. and Jack, when they were in camp one summer, and they were filled with world events and what was going on. And my two kids, the same age, 7 and 6, were in sleepaway camp that same summer. And I looked at my letters, which seemed really thin by comparison. So I was telling them about our dog, Muggsy, and what movies we'd seen. So I decided I'd better make my letters a little better. So the next time I wrote to them, I talked about Oliver North. It was the summer of the Iran-Contra hearings. And they wrote back and they said, Mom, what's happened to you? This is terrible. We want to hear about our dog and what movies did you see? So then I realized maybe it was more fun reading those letters after the fact than getting them as a kid. But anyway, yes, that was the second story.
And then the Roosevelts.
And then Franklin and Eleanor. I wanted to write about a woman, but there had just been, as always, a great set of trilogy about Eleanor Roosevelt, but I wanted to write about her. So I remember calling Arthur Schlesinger up and I said, and I knew I couldn't write about the war because I don't understand battles, and I knew that would flanks and all that stuff. So I called Arthur Schlesinger, my friend, up. I said, if I write about the home front instead of the war front, will it be true that Eleanor would be a true partner? And he said, absolutely, she was Mrs. Homefront. And what a treat to write about Eleanor. I mean, the first woman who speaks at a national convention, the first woman who has a radio show, the first woman who has a press conference where she only allows female reporters to come. So an entire generation of female journalists get their start because publishers have to have a female at her press conference. And I love their relationship. I mean, it just showed and for this, I'm sure Anne would be thinking about this in writing her book, but there was a complicated relationship, an affair that happened, but it transformed Eleanor because then she felt free to have her own life beyond the married life, and she becomes Eleanor Roosevelt. And so that was a really fun book to write about.
Right. How did you get from FDR and Eleanor to Lincoln?
Well, after you've done FDR and World War II and you want something dramatic, you can't really go back to Millard Fillmore or Franklin Pierce.
I tried that, yeah.
So
Chester Arthur, though. Whoa.
So I always wanted to, it was scary, though, because I've never studied the 19th century before. Everything had been 20th century. And I really did want to write about Abraham Lincoln. It's like the Moby Dick for historians, Abraham Lincoln. But I knew I couldn't just write, of course, about him. So I thought, in the first 2 years of the 10 years, I thought I'd write about Abe and Mary, just as I had done Franklin and Eleanor. But I realized shortly into it that she couldn't carry the public side of the story the same way that Eleanor could, obviously. And I didn't want to just be writing about their private lives. So I luckily went up to the house, just by chance, where Seward had lived, his Secretary of State, the counterpart to Hillary Clinton and Obama. And his house is still in family hands. It's a fabulous museum. And you can see the books he read with his notes. You see the chair where he had his tobacco and his snuff. And I got really interested in him, so I started reading his letters. And then I realized he had written his wife every day, 10-page letters. And then I got interested in his comments about the other cabinet members, some of whom he hated, some of whom he liked. So all of a sudden, instead of Mary and Abe, it became the cabinet and the rivals that he had and their interpersonal relationship with Lincoln. And it was so clear from listening to all of their letters and their diaries what a master he was in politics in dealing with these human relations, because some of these people, they wouldn't even be in the same room with each other. They hated each other, Chase and Stanton, for example. But I loved them all. Not Chase, I didn't love him. He was so stuffy and he was so mean to Lincoln.
You gotta have some standards.
Yeah.
No Chase. And I imagine just in the ascending scale, having done FDR and Lincoln, TR presented himself as a...
Well, I think what happened is when I was a graduate student at Harvard, I taught a seminar on the Progressive Era and Teddy Roosevelt. And also when I was a little girl, I grew up in Long Island and my parents took me to Sagamore Hill. So too had they taken me to Hyde Park. I think there's nothing better to engender in a kid a sense of history than the house. You know, you go to a museum and you're separated by glass from the stuff, but you're walking around a house where these people lived. I remember when I went to Hyde Park the first time and I saw Roosevelt's glasses on the desk, and I saw Fowler's leash on the chaise lounge, and I said to the docent or whatever they were called, I said, he can't be dead, his glasses are here and his cigarette holder is there. You know, it was then I began to realize, you know, he isn't dead if you can tell a story about him. And similarly, I went to Sagamore Hill, so I'd always been interested in Teddy. And I knew that being, I didn't know that Taft was going to come into it at the beginning, but there's something about his colorful nature, about his mental curiosity. And he said of himself, which I love thinking about, that he was an ordinary man with extraordinary perseverance. He worked hard at everything he did, whether it was making his body early on, reading, he slaved over books. He said, I'm not a great writer, but I've written 40 books. I don't have good eyesight, but I've become a world-class birder. I'm not a good shot, but I have a wild animal reputation. And so there was something about this character. And the stories about him are just so funny. One of my favorite ones in terms of his physical energy, as I was saying, when he would take these people through Rock Creek Park on these jogs every afternoon from the White House. And Rock Creek Park was pretty wooded then. I mean, it may still be. I haven't walked through it for a while. But anyway, the point was that you could never go around an obstacle. You had to go, if there's a rock, you have to go up it. If there's a precipice, you have to go down it. So all these stories of ambassadors and cabinet members falling along the way. But the best story was told by the French ambassador. And he was so excited, the first walk with the president, he wore his silk hat and his great outfit, and he thinks they're going to be in the Champs-Élysées, and he gets through the woods, and he's dying, and he's going, and they finally come to a river. He says, thank God, this is over. And then he said later when he wrote, judge of my horror when I saw the president unbutton his clothes and say, well, we had better strip so as not to wet our clothes in the river. And so then he said, so I too, for the honor of France, stripped. Except, he said, I left on my lavender kid gloves. And why? Because it would be very embarrassing if you met ladies on the other side. So every time I thought of this ambassador, when he comes in, all I'm picturing is this naked guy with lavender kid gloves. So how can you resist a guy like that?
There'll always be a France.
There'll always be a France.
I would imagine, one of the things that always fascinated me was Churchill and TR didn't like each other. Churchill was a young man, obviously, when TR was middle-aged. And Alice Roosevelt Longworth was asked once, why didn't your father like Winston Churchill? And she responded, perhaps they were too much alike. Compare and contrast.
Well, that's a really interesting thought. And you know more about this than I do, so I may ask you to do the ultimate comparing and contrasting, because also Churchill comes into Teddy's life after 1912, and when I end a book, except there's an epilogue, I don't really know that much, but I can tell you a naked Churchill story.
Always good. This is a metaphysical conceit we have taken with the manliness.
No, actually, what happened is when I was writing Franklin and Eleanor, I became obsessed with the idea that he had all these people living in the White House with him during World War II because he wanted to have a cocktail party every night so that the people would be ready for the cocktail party because he wanted the party to not have to talk about the war so he could relax. And so that meant that Harry Hopkins, his foreign policy advisor, when he came for dinner, stayed over one night, never left till the war came to an end. His secretary, Missy Lehand, lives there. Princess Martha from Norway in exile during America is there on the weekends. And, of course, the great Winston Churchill, as you know, is there for weeks and weeks at a time in a bedroom diagonally across from Roosevelt's. So when I was writing the book, I just kept saying, oh, God, why wouldn't I was up there with Lyndon Johnson? Why didn't I think of asking, where did Churchill sleep? Where was Roosevelt? Where was Harry Hopkins? But of course, I wasn't thinking in those terms when I was in my 20s. So I mentioned this on a radio program in Washington, which Hillary Clinton happened to be listening to. So she invited me to come and sleep at the White House so we could wander the corridor together and figure out where everyone had slept. So anyway, 2 weeks later, she followed up with an invitation to a state dinner, after which, between midnight and 2 a.m., the president, Mrs. Clinton, my husband, and I went through every room up there with my map in hand, figured out, yes, Chelsea Clinton is sleeping where Harry Hopkins was, Clinton's are where FDR, we were in Churchill's bedroom, which meant there was no way I could sleep. Your friend and mine, drinking his brandy, smoking his cigar, and the scene, maybe apocryphal, I'm sure you've heard it too, but a great story. It's got to be true. It's so much fun. That Churchill is there right after Pearl Harbor. They're supposed to sign a document that puts the Associated Nations against the Axis powers. But the Associated Nations, no one liked the word. Roosevelt awakens that morning with the whole new idea of calling them the United Nations, has himself wheeled into Churchill's bedroom to tell him news, but Churchill's just coming out of the bathtub, and yet, of course, has nothing on. So Roosevelt says, I'm so sorry, I'll come back in a few moments, but Churchill, ever able to speak in a very formal voice, said, oh no, please stay. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States. So, I mean, can you hear me? You're naked and, you know, and you can say that.
Right. FDR said to Grace Tully, his secretary afterward, you know, Grace, he's pink and white all over.
I forgot that. That's right.
That's our confirmation. No defense of marriage act there. Churchill, TR, that era, wonderfully progressive in their way, also by our standards, terribly retrograde. So you mentioned Arthur Schlesinger a moment ago. One of the things that I think that Arthur contributed to what we do in such a remarkable way was the principle that self-righteousness in retrospect is easy, also cheap.
Yep.
And so I'm just wondering, but you came of age, your husband wrote the great voting rights speech for President Johnson, so much of American scripture came from him, and you were so shaped by those events. It must be difficult when you're reading essentially white supremacist, Anglo-Saxon superiority rhetoric in that period. How do you personally wrestle with that?
Oh, I mean, I think there were two things I had to wrestle with. One was the comments that he would make about where America should be in the world and the occupation of the Philippine Islands, and comments even about race at that time, even though he did have Booker T. Washington to the White House, which produced an outrage in the South, showing where it was, there was a really fine line to walk at that time. But even so, you always do get, I mean, I'll always be disappointed in FDR for the incarceration of Japanese Americans, for not bringing more Jewish refugees into the country before Hitler closed the door forever. And for Teddy, it's not only these attitudes that he had, which may have been conventional or not, but you wish that your people were ahead of themselves. But his attitudes toward war are just crazy. I mean, he'll say the victories of war are better than the victories of peace, no matter when. You know, and it's interesting. My youngest son, Joey, had graduated from Harvard in June of 01 and written his senior honors thesis on Teddy Roosevelt and loved him. And then September 11th happened, and the next day my son volunteered for the Army. And he was a platoon leader in Baghdad for two tours of duty and was in combat, earned a Bronze Star, and then eventually was called back to Afghanistan. And we talked about Teddy Roosevelt afterwards. He said he could never look at him the same way, how anybody could romanticize war after having been in it. He would never understand. And I think I feel the same way. But I was writing mostly about the progressive era, the domestic and economic stuff. So even though that's a piece of it, I didn't have to focus on that, because it's a difficult part, both sides of him. And I think that, and I'm glad I wasn't writing about when he was wanting us to get in World War I a lot earlier, when he was really mad that we weren't doing it. And there was something about that little kid who was fragile and romanticized strong people and soldiers. It never left him. And I think, too, his father had, he adored this father, but he found out as he got older that the father had hired a substitute for the Civil War. And somehow that undid him, the idea that the father hadn't fought in that war. So of course he runs into the Rough Rider thing. In fact, he wrote a memoir about his Rough Rider days, and a famous journalist named Peter Dunn, who wrote in the guise of Mr. Dooley, an Irish bartender, he was read all over the country. He wrote a review of his memoir in which he said he placed himself in the center of action so much he should have called it Alone in Cuba. And so, but to Teddy Roosevelt's credit, what does he do? He writes a letter to Mr. Dunn and says, I regret to tell you that my family and friends are delighted with your review of my book. Now you owe me one. I've always wanted to make your acquaintance. Please come visit me the next time you come east. I mean, that was his charm and his strength, that he could laugh at himself, and he made this remarkable set of relationships with the press. I mean, it was really unprecedented, the access he gave them and the friendships he developed.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about the influence that TR's legacy and image had on his young cousin.
On FDR. Yes, I mean, FDR, of course, you know, I'm sure, what the relationship is, even though it's kind of tangled.
We're Southerners, so, it's fine. That's just called Christmas down here.
Oh my God, I knew this would be fun, as long as we're not. So anyway, Teddy Roosevelt had a younger brother named Elliot Roosevelt, and Elliot had epilepsy as a child and later became an alcoholic and became the father of Eleanor Roosevelt. And it was a very tough thing for Eleanor as a little girl, because her mother was the most beautiful woman of her age. Portrait painters vied to paint her, and she thought that, and Eleanor always knew that her mother thought she had an ugly face. And the mother used to call her Granny, actually, because she looked so stuffy as a girl. And then the mother dies when she's 9. The father tries to jump out of a window and dies not long thereafter. So Teddy actually becomes the person who gives Franklin and Eleanor away at the wedding while he's president. And they said, of course, all attention was on him rather than FDR or Eleanor. In fact, as you know, Alice Roosevelt made this funny comment that Teddy so liked being in the center of action, he wanted to be the bride at the wedding and the baby at the baptism and the corpse at the funeral. So anyway, FDR rose up as a young Democrat because his father was a Democrat, despite Teddy being a Republican, but models his life on Teddy, becomes Assistant Secretary of the Navy, as was Teddy, becomes Governor of New York. And there's interesting correspondence between them. Even in 1912, I think they shared many of the progressive values at that point. He eventually, of course, goes for Wilson, who is the one who appoints him as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. But he knows the power that Teddy has, and I think really idolized Teddy Roosevelt. And they had a relationship, I mean, not a really close one, but he was the person, if you're looking out as FDR, this is the one I want to be.
Right. I think we all know about TR's legacy. He looms extraordinarily large in the life of the nation. Taft does not. And so what surprised you most? What did you come away from with your time with President Taft that we should know?
Well, I think the most important thing, besides the fact that he's a really decent, fundamentally fair, honest, good man. You know, perhaps sometimes those qualities don't translate as well into politics because he didn't have the kind of willingness to fight. His mother once said to him when he was trying to decide between a Supreme Court appointment, which Teddy tried to give him 3 times when he was still president, and it was what he really wanted. But his wife Nellie, I should tell you about her without just keep saying his wife Nellie, and I will in a minute. Anyway, he chose the political route, which wasn't suited for him in some ways, because his mother said to him, the malice of politics will make you miserable. You're not a fighter like Teddy. But what made me surprised was that the two of them, throughout Teddy's whole presidency, really did share a conviction that is at the heart of the progressive era, which is that the problems of the industrial age, whether they were working men's conditions or the big monopolies that were squeezing out smaller businesses, or the gap between the rich and the poor, or the fact that there were unregulated drugs flooding the market, bad sanitary conditions in the meat pack, Taft was absolutely at one with Teddy in believing the government had a responsibility to do something to ease these problems. And that was a huge shift from the whole period, from the Civil War to the Progressive Era, when there was a feeling that if government intervened in any way, it would destroy the prosperity of the country. So in 1912, when they end up running against each other, Taft is inevitably put into the more conservative role. He does not betray Teddy's legacy, in my judgment, which is what Teddy thought. Teddy makes him president, essentially, in 1908. He runs his campaign. He picks him as his successor because he had been the most important person in his cabinet. When Teddy would go off on his bear hunts or on his long whistle-stop tours around the country, and the reporters would say to him, what's going to happen in your absence? He'd say, don't worry, I've left Taft sitting on the lid. And then, of course, these cartoons of Taft sitting on the lid. And then he told Taft he thought he was the best suited to be his successor. He constantly advised him during the campaign, you know, don't just answer Williams Jennings Bryan, attack him. Hit him hard, man. Let him see you smile, you big beloved fellow. Let him see you smile. Your nature shines through. He told him he shouldn't play golf like he was playing because it was a working man. The working man didn't like golf. It was a rich man's game. The only thing I think he didn't influence was the song that was Taft's song was, get on a raft with Taft. If you got on a raft with 350-pound Taft, you wouldn't be on it very long. But anyway, I think what I hadn't known was that when Teddy comes back from Africa and his progressive friends tell him that Taft has betrayed his legacy, and it really wasn't that. He tried to get a tariff reform bill through, which Teddy had never touched. He knew it would break the Republican Party in two because the Eastern manufacturers wanted a high tariff, the Westerners wanted a low tariff. Taft bravely takes it on, but in doing so, he compromises so much with the old guard and the Republican side that it comes out as a great disappointment to the progressives, and they begin to turn against Taft. And then when Teddy comes back and hears the disappointments, he decides that he will run against him. But I think the biggest revelation to me was how emotional it was for both men when this happened. And the way I know that is because of the Sewanee graduate, Archie Butt.
So. And rightly.
Okay, so can I tell you? Oh, first I have to tell you about Nellie, because this is important. So Nellie, unlike...
Story of Sewanee's life, right? Yeah. There. We'll get to it in a second.
Well, we will, I promise. But it's I've just made these little comments about Nellie. So she grows up as an adolescent in Cincinnati, and also in a middle-class family, and a family that she should have been going into society. But she just craves a larger life, even from the time she's young. And so she decides she won't marry. She wants to be a teacher. She becomes a teacher. Her mother warns her that's the, you know, she'll never marry if she keeps working. And she thinks that's fine. I want something vital in my life. But then she meets young Will Taft, and he adores her and respects her intelligence and essentially promises her, not with words, but almost with words when you read their letters, that she will be his partner. And she loved politics from the time she was young. And she used to go to the bars in Cincinnati and they'd talk politics with laborers and merchants. She was a progressive way ahead of her time. And then when he's making those choices along the way, she feels politics is a more vital life than the court would be, where he'd be around a lot of older people and a more sedentary life. So her influence really not only helps him to make those choices to go to Solicitor General, then Governor General of the Philippines, where she leaves a permanent mark by producing sterilized milk and really helps infant mortality in the country. And then when he comes back and he's in the cabinet, she loves being in Washington, and he depends on her for strategy, for everything. And then when she's finally becomes First Lady, she's one of the most activist First Ladies they'd had in generation. She concerned with working class women. She brings the cherry trees to Washington. More importantly, she creates a free park where there's free concerts, and her guest list is expanded, whereas Edith Roosevelt had been much more of an aristocrat as a First Lady. And then what really undoes Taft, and this is why, unless you know the personal things, you just think, okay, he wasn't as progressive as Teddy, and that's what had happened. But after 2 months in the presidency, and he was doing really pretty well the first 2 months, despite not being suited temperamentally in some way for the public spotlight, they go sailing on a yacht. She has a fainting spell, and it turns out it's a stroke. She recovers her ability to walk, but she could never speak in connected sentences again. It was devastating. Archie Butt and Sewanee, which we'll get back to in a second, who wrote letters to his family every day, thank God we love Archie Butt, said that he'd never seen a man more stricken. He looked like a stricken animal. And he would spend hours with her trying to teach her how to say the, or trying to teach her how to say glad to see you, happy you're here, so she could be part of the receptions. And nobody knew how devastating her stroke was. and you wonder why his presidency fell short. I mean, these are the things that happen to a person that may have transformed. They may never have been a great president. After Teddy Roosevelt, it would have been really hard. And he also sort of stood still politically where the country was moving further to the left, and Teddy was moving with it, and he was staying where they had both been together. But anyway, there's a guy named Archie Butt who was a writer early on, loved writing at Sewanee, loved the South, and then joined the military. And he became the military aide to Teddy and then stayed on with Taft. And he was very close to Teddy. I mean, Teddy later said about him that he felt toward him like a son. And there was no one outside the family that he cared about more than Archie. He was never married, Archie. He was handsome. He was very social. And he loved gossip, which is great for us historians. And he's writing every day to his mother and then later to his sister-in-law. And then he stays on with Taft. And then when Teddy starts coming back against Taft, it breaks his heart because he loves both men. He tries desperately to bring them together, and he does little things that do it. But then at some point, he was supposed to take a vacation in the spring of 1912, and he worried about whether he should really go or not, but Teddy hadn't announced yet for the presidency, so he made plans to go to Europe. And then in February, Teddy says his hat is in the ring. The very next morning, he decides, I can't leave Taft now. I mean, I'll feel like a quitter in going. Teddy had sent a cryptic message to him right before he announced, saying, I think you should leave the White House, meaning he knew that that meant he was going to run, thinking that his loyalty to Teddy would bring him out away from Taft, but he felt equally loyal to Taft, and he said he would feel terrible if he left Taft, because Taft needed him probably even more than Teddy. He was there with Nellie when she was at receptions and she'd get mixed up. He was able to talk for her. Anyway, he decides that he's not going to go to Europe. He cancels his sailing orders, and Taft comes in and says, no, you've got to go now. I know you need a rest. I know what you've been through, and you'll be back. You'll be back in 6 weeks or so, and the campaign will be in full swing then. He goes to Europe. He comes back on the Titanic, and he dies. And the incredible thing is there's a woman who, as the ship was already partially going down, there was a woman who actually knew Taft enough so that she wrote him a long letter. She said, I know you'll want to hear about what Archie talked about in that last night after the ship had already hit the iceberg. And he told her that he had saved all these letters and that he'd been writing these letters. And he was a journalist originally. And he thought maybe it would leave a little bit of his legacy if they had been saved and if somebody wanted to do something with them someday. And so these letters are now in 3 volumes. They are gold for an historian. And Archie Butt from Sewanee is one of the characters in my book.
That's right. You may not know this about Sewanee. It's best understood as Downton Abbey meets Deliverance. I know you've not, but we love it. As Daniel Webster said, it's a small college, sir, but there goes another.
But we love it.
We were talking before about the other thing, if you want to be important in history, it's very important to have good penmanship, because there are so many people, I found people in the Jackson archives who held enormously important positions, wrote page after page, but they were totally indecipherable.
Right, absolutely.
And so it's these small things that...
No, I remember actually when I was doing the Lincoln book, and again I spoke to Arthur Schlesinger, and he said, you're going to have real trouble with Salmon Chase's handwriting. It's indecipherable. But what was lucky is that when Salmon Chase's daughter, Kate, was in school, she was in a boarding school when she's like 7, and he was writing to her, and he wrote really big. So I used that as a template to read the rest of his writing.
It's like the historian enigma project. Yeah. Important. Let's come to the present a little bit. Well, first of all, Doris and I have a longstanding running conversation about titles. And the virtues and vices thereof. Where did the bully pulpit come from?
Well, I think after I got into Teddy and Taft, I realized that what really distinguished the successful leadership of Teddy and the falling short of Taft was that Teddy understood how to communicate to the country, and he defined, as I say, the phrase the bully pulpit as the platform on which a president can educate the country. And he had a remarkable relationship with the press, who becomes his channel to the bully to the American people. So another set of characters in the book are these people at McClure's magazine, who are probably the most talented group of journalists ever to be in one place at one time. Ida Tarbell, Ray Baker, William Allen White, and Lincoln Steffens. And what happens is their founder, Sam McClure, oh, this is something that makes me so happy. I just found out today from somebody who's at Knox College where McClure went. McClure was an incredible character, the founder of this magazine. He was a manic depressive. And when he was manic and a genius, he created this magazine. He gave these reporters 2 years to do their research so that it would be impregnable what they wrote before they had to write a word with expense accounts galore. Anyway, he went to Knox College. He was very poor. His father had died in Ireland. And they're going to have a McClure festival as a result of this book. And then
oh,
you
great.
Feel like, I really brought him back.
That's
and
great.
It makes you
That's
feel
great.
So happy because he deserves it. I mean, so Teddy understood that these people had a channel to the public. Not only could he communicate on his Whistle Stop tours, but they were communicating through stories. And so Ida Tarbell writes a story. I mean, when he first started talking about the trusts, which is the word they used for monopolies, it was so abstract that people didn't respond. But then Ida Tarbell writes about how John D. Rockefeller had come into northwestern Pennsylvania, where her father had had an independent oil company, and he just squelched them all and used unfair and illegal means to gain his monopoly. And suddenly people understood what it was. In fact, she became the most famous journalist of her era, a crusader, a Joan of Arc. They finally said in the newspapers that J.D. Rockefeller, she never married because she, unlike Nellie, never found the partner who would give her the freedom to do what she wanted. So she prayed at age 14 that she would never take a husband so that she'd have the freedom to become this writer, which she became, an extraordinary writer. And they said in the newspaper that John D. Rockefeller would pay any man who would marry her and take her around the world endlessly so she would stop writing. And then Lincoln Steffens wrote about corruption in the city through stories. Ray Baker wrote about the abuses of the railroad through stories. Upton Sinclair writes The Jungle, a novel that then mobilized people to worry about the sanitary conditions of the meatpacking plants. And Roosevelt became close to all of these people. He would have them for lunch and dinner. They could even come in when he was being shaved in the barber's hour, and the press were allowed in to ask him questions. They said the barber had to be a genius because he was gesticulating the whole time. And somehow they kept their integrity. They could criticize him. He would constantly criticize them as being impractical reformers, and they could criticize him in print. And it was a relationship that really strengthened his presidency. And so too he would communicate when he went out on the road in these train stops. He loved being among the people, and he would stop at every village station and over again talk about the square deal. That was the slogan, the first person that ever had a slogan for their presidency. And it meant, I'm not against the rich, I'm not against the poor, but I'm against the corporations that don't do fairly, I'm against unions that don't do fairly. It was exactly where the country was. But he knew how to talk in a shorthand language in a way that repeated over and over again in simple terms, speak softly and carry a big stick, blah, blah, blah. But he had the extra bully pulpit of the press. So eventually, since I was always having trouble with titles, the bully pulpit seemed to signify the difference, because Taft never spoke in shorthand. He gave long legal briefs when he spoke. He wasn't happy with the relationship with the press. As a judge, you didn't have to deal with the press, so he didn't know why he was going to have to talk to them and schmooze with them. And just even when Teddy was out on the train trip, he just loved being with the people. Taft was actually very amiable. One-on-one, he was probably as warm or even warmer than Teddy. But when he's sitting in the train, he doesn't think he has to wave to people all the time. He's self-conscious about it. Whereas Teddy is waving so constantly that at one point, when he tells Archie Butt that he was waving, and these people seemed rather cold and indifferent, and he finally found out it was a herd of cows that he was waving at. So I think that's the reason. And I do think, as your question suggests, it has an impact on the present about whether the bully pulpit still has the power that it had then.
And your view?
I think it doesn't. I mean, I think perhaps President Obama hasn't made of it what we would have expected given his great communication skills. I think right now he's trying to use it to break down the healthcare law into component parts, so that he knows that polls show that individual parts are very popular and they have to just be repetitively told to people what they are, he's hoping. Instead, the law itself never made a clear understanding for the public of what it was, or at least didn't persuade them that it was something they wanted it to be. And so part of it may be him. Maybe sometimes a president needs the people when he's out on a campaign trail and The energy comes in from the people. Even FDR, when he did his radio chats, would always have people there, even though he's just talking to a microphone, because he needed that sense of people being there. But I would also argue that the power of the bully pulpit has been diminished for modern presidents. From the time when Teddy was using it, his speeches would be in full in the newspaper. His shorthand phrases would be headlines. It was the common conversation. There's not a lot of other things distracting people at the time. And when you get up to FDR, and he's giving his radio fireside chats, and 80% of the adult audience is listening to him. Saul Bellow said you could walk down the street on a hot Chicago night and look in the windows of everybody whose windows would be open because it was hot, and you could hear that same voice coming every single house along the way. And there weren't pundits that were criticizing the radio address before it was done. You get up to even the television era with JFK through Reagan. There's three networks. They go back to their ordinary programming after it's finished. Now what happens? The president might give a speech. You're watching your favorite cable network. You may never hear the whole speech. You may hear people like John and me talking about the speech just minutes after it's done. And then breaking news comes in minutes later, and whatever the topic of conversation was, the next thing we're on something else. And we're so distracted now that whether we have a conversation about our national problems is much lessened. So I think the institution itself, maybe somebody will figure out how to deal with the current world. And it's just as Roosevelt understood that national newspapers had come into being at the 20th century, and FDR understood the radio was the child of the radio, and JFK and Reagan understood television. Maybe there's some new method of communication that we need here. I mean, I think Teddy would have been pretty good on Twitter because he could do these shorthand phrases. But I don't know what Lincoln would have done in today's world, because his speeches were beautifully written, and you read the whole speech in a pamphlet, and you spent time and you talked about it in your neighborhood, and he didn't even like to give shorthand speeches. When there was a victory in the war and somebody would come and ask him to comment, unless he had something that he'd worked on that was written, even though he was great, talking one-on-one, and he could be funny and he was so quick, he wanted to make sure that his speeches were thought out before he gave them. So I don't know how any of these characters in the past would have. I mean, I've got to believe Lincoln would be fine if he just lost the beard and the top hat. I think he'd still be okay.
But that's true of President Obama, you know, who is attacked for using a teleprompter, but that's because, as he puts it, he cares about what he says.
Right. I mean, if you care about the words, then you don't want to just give a shorthand version of it. That's the danger, maybe, of being a writer. It was perfect in Lincoln's time. You're a writer, and your speeches are written, and they're read as you wrote them. And the pamphlets would then be sent out by your party, and people are reading the whole speech. And that just doesn't happen today.
Right. What is the lesson you want folks who are going to buy many copies this evening to give to their very large families here?
Their large Southern families.
Their large Southern families. That's right. Is it recovering an unappreciated figure in Taft? Is it trying to figure out what it is that goes in, what are the factors that go into creating concerted public action? What do you want us to take away?
I suppose in some ways, that last part of your question, there is a sense that what made the progressive era deal with the problems of the age was that there was an inability for Congress to act. The old guard was in charge of the Republican Party, and Roosevelt understood that the public itself had to demand action. And when they did demand action, finally they couldn't keep the bills bottled up in the committee anymore. Once they got to the floor, they had to pass them, and they actually turned out to be popular. And they helped the Republican Party win the midterm elections in 02, 04, 06, until, of course, they split apart later on after Taft's elected. But I'm not sure that the lessons matter. I mean, it is true there's some connection between today and the turn of the 20th century. People say, did you think about that when you were writing? The truth is that I started so long ago, the gap between the rich and the poor and the things we're talking about today wasn't as much in the, just that history cycles back because I take so long. But mostly I think, just like people said, you must have thought about, you know, Hillary Clinton when you started Lincoln. I didn't even know barely who Obama was when I began Lincoln. But I think more importantly, what I really care about is a story. I mean, I think history is best told when it's a story and when it's stories of people who lived before and you can learn from their struggles and triumphs. I mean, that's what we really care about. And, you know, I think I've always said that, you know, the thing I'll always be so grateful to my father for having taught me that mysterious art of keeping score was that I learned not only how to tell a story, but then was able in private to pass his memory down. He died when I was still in my 20s, before I had my three boys. But through the stories that he had told me and through the stories I told him, and through my mother died when I was 15, but she loved reading even though she had only an eighth grade education. And then I used to be obsessed with asking her to tell me stories of the days when she was young, because she had had rheumatic heart fever when she was young, and so she had damaged arteries and was really an invalid through my childhood. And I thought if I could get her to tell me stories about the days when she was younger, that somehow her mind would control her body and she would be rejuvenated. And so stories mattered so much to me. I always wondered why my kids never asked me to tell them stories of the days when I was younger, but for some reason it mattered to me. So in the end, I guess what I'd like to believe is just as my kids, when I go to a baseball game now, we have season tickets now to the Red Sox. When the Dodgers abandoned us, I couldn't even follow baseball. Then I moved to Boston and became an equally irrational Red Sox fan. Had an incredible summer this summer. Made me so happy. I was finishing the book. I was so late. And I wasn't reading the newspapers. I wasn't going on any television. I wasn't doing any lectures. I was just writing, except reading the box scores every morning because the Red Sox won 97 games. Anyways.
Is it true, by the way, that you can't watch in clutch situations?
Oh, it's ridiculous. I leave the room. And I mean, we went to every playoff game and we went to the World Series games, and those games were so horrible. They were 1-0, 2-1, until the final game, the sixth game, where we were winning the whole time and I didn't leave my seat. It was very happy. But anyway, just to get back to your question, so I think that when I'm at the game sometimes I can close my eyes and imagine myself, even with them, when I'm with my own boys, that I'm a young girl once more in the presence of my father, watching the players of my youth, Jackie Robinson, you know, Pee Wee Reese, Duke Snyder, and Gil Hodges. And then I see my sons in the place where my father sat, and I feel this invisible loyalty and love linking my sons to the grandfather whose face they never had a chance to see, but I know they've learned his heart and soul through the stories I've told. So in the end, what I really care about is just trying to bring these people who walked this earth so many years ago back to life again, just as in our private life, when we've lost people in our families, it's so important to tell the stories of their lives, as I had to do because my parents died when I was young. And I think what I care about more than any lessons or what impact it has on today is hopefully that for the people who read the book, Teddy and Taft and Edith and Nellie and Archie Budd and the Muckrakers will live again for a little while.
Well, there is no better storyteller at work today. And thank you, ma'am.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you very much.